the experts. Secondly, they're just citizens. They don't run the place, they don't get a big salary, so they have marvelous trustworthiness. Furthermore, they're located everywhere, in all sectors of society, in all age groups, and it is that group that is essentially going to be the determining factor. And I think I can already predict that the particular hospital using that technique is going to be the surviving major medical center, and the other two who have instead used media campaigns or political pressure are in fact not going to be the survivors. Second story. One of our hospital clients, has been, similar to the one I mentioned earlier, owned by its municipality. The findings we were able to convince. The experts. Secondly, they're just citizens. They don't run the place, they don't get a big salary, so they have marvelous trustworthiness. Furthermore, they're located everywhere, in all sectors of society, in all age groups, and it is that group that is essentially going to be the determining factor. And I think I can already predict that the particular hospital using that technique is going to be the surviving major medical center, and the other two who have instead used media campaigns or political pressure are in fact not going to be the survivors. Second story. One of our hospital clients, has been, similar to the one I mentioned earlier, owned by its municipality. The findings, we were able to convince the municipality, the citizens, the voters, as well as the elected officials, that this was not a good way to manage sophisticated modern-day health care. But the perceptions that we found out there among the people when we began this process, I think, is instructive. Certainly, people do not trust elected officials today, no question of that. But given the choice between trusting elected officials, whom at least they could vote for or against, and trusting hospital trustees and management, in whose selection they had no voice, the people of that community for 20 years had resisted any efforts to remove that hospital to the more normal situation of a nonprofit community-based institution. Notice what was involved. Had nothing to do with the medical care. Nothing whatsoever. Strictly perceptions of the relationship of the ability of people in a marketing mode to participate in the management of that hospital. We could have had the most marvelous doctors in the world. Indeed, if this were Mass General or one of the hospitals associated with McGill, or name your great hospital, I trust the situation would have been no different. The people's perception was they wanted a voice in whatever was going to happen. That's public relationships, not the science of medicine. Third war story. I said I had been involved in a long strike of nurses. I have indeed. The particular hospital that was struck was targeted for the strike by the National Nurses Association in the United States, and their case is a good one. They don't make a comparable amount of money for the services they provide on a rational basis. Their case is a damn good one. On the other hand, this hospital was a teaching hospital, a large teaching hospital, but in an area where there are two other hospitals. As patient load comes down, as money available comes down, competitive situation. Those nurses, by striking, sent a message to the community. They came very close to closing the doors. I don't mean, this was one of those typical threats by an unthinking board of trustees. If you don't knuckle under to our demands, we'll close the place. I mean, the dollar signs on the bottom line were saying to reputable trustees, hey, we're going to have to close this place if we can't solve this and get back to full operation. Notice what was involved there. What was involved there was the relationships between the institution and one of its key publics, and then the spillover of that to the larger public. Had nothing to do with the quality of medical care, nothing to do with the science of medicine. So I stand by my point that public relationships are going to be more important to healthcare than anything else, including what I hope will continue to be the marvelous advances in the science of medicine. In fact, as a side note, I think the marvelous advances in the science of medicine are one of our problems. We have not dealt with the public's perceptions of the science of medicine. We have not tempered their expectations. And so the public is now expecting a new cure every other week, as you know, and certainly a cure for whatever it is they have when they come in the door within a couple of days so they can get back to work or fishing or television or whatever it is. Those, my friends, are issues that we should be able to deal with as professional public relations practitioners and as managers who understand the role of this. So let me quickly talk about forming public relationships. There are three basic sociological principles involved in public relationships. The first is an old rule that it's so old, I think it's not only sociological, I think it's probably anthropological, and that is the sociological rule which I call the rule of abuses. Pardon my spelling, I always get a few extra bumps in the U just to make it interesting. This rule postulates that any change in the relationship between two groups is the result of an abuse on the part of one. Any change in the relationship between two groups is the result of an abuse on the part of one. Now, we all know that that abuse may be an actual abuse or it may just be a perceived abuse. But, of course, public relations professionals know that perceptions are facts, even if they're dead wrong. That perception is a fact because a person is acting on it. So therefore, whether the abuse is real or perceived, present or historic, is unimportant. The point is, if you're going to build public relationships, you have to stand back and ask yourself, what are, first of all, the historic abuses between the institution and this public? Secondly, what are any currently felt abuses? And thirdly, what are the possible areas into which we could venture which would be considered an abuse by that public? Now, let me give you an example. Let's go back to the nurses. The historic abuse in the nurses' strike was the translation many years ago of the military model of management into the medical model of management. The nurse had no say, doctor was God, and they were just carrying out orders and often under most unfriendly conditions. At least that's the downside. We all know that probably 95% was the upside, where an intelligent doctor naturally asked the nurse's opinion, but there was enough of that old stuff still kicking around that historic abuse had to be dealt with before we could talk to them about anything else. It's kind of like going into the South as a politician of the United States, or perhaps as an English-speaking politician, going to Quebec and saying, now I really feel for you people, and I'm with you, and I'm going to deal with it, and then just going ahead with business as usual. Until that politician can truly convince that audience that, hey, I mean it. I do feel with you your historic abuse, and I want to help overcome the last vestiges. Until that happens, they cannot even hear what that person is saying. So that was our historic abuse. The current abuse happened to be an issue of pay. They felt that they were, in ratio at least, underpaid. They wanted more money. The worst part of it is, I don't know if this data has gotten up here yet, but one of the unions that represents supermarket checkout clerks, damn their hide, went and won a contract last year that pays them about a half more than nurses make. And so the great cry in front of all the supermarkets with the banners was, you know, checkout clerks make more than I do, with all the nurses with their nursing caps. Powerful stuff. That was the current abuse. The possible abuse, and we had to do a lot of study to get this, the possible abuse turned out with nurses to be that abuse which is the number one abuse all employee groups have felt for the last 25 years, according to Opinion Research Corporation's 25-year survey of several thousand employee surveys across the country. I will not be fully informed. That's the possible abuse. They're not going to tell me what's really going on around this place. And I'm almost paranoid about it. Well, those were the three abuses in that particular case. I think you get the point of what I'm talking about. The first rule of building a relationship is to know how people have been abused, rightly or wrongly. Never mind whether it's true. How do they feel about it? And to deal with those before we try to do anything else. You're not going to build a relationship with a person sitting there with a simmering abuse because they're going to distrust you and just wait for the wrong word or the false step until bingo, end of relationship. The second rule of building relationships is what we call the ignorance rule. The ignorance rule postulates something like this, that lack of trust in a person, institution, or whatever is a function of ignorance. Lack of trust is a function of ignorance. Now, it's quickly apparent that there's two sides of ignorance there. Clearly, there's the ignorance of the untrusting public. They don't know enough about the institution. Of course, there's always that case where maybe the lack of trust is there because they do know enough about the institution. I'm assuming you have good policies and, you know, operate properly and have done the three things we talked about in the first half of our time together. In addition to that, there is ignorance on the part of the institution about the people out there. So that the clear goal here is to look for areas of ignorance. Now again, ignorance may be factual. Maybe they don't know that you really don't always wait an hour and a half in your emergency room, that theirs was a rare case. I see a lot of smiles on that one. On the other hand, maybe it's something that is actual, that they really don't know, for example, that you have a new cardiac unit and that grandmother could have gone there or should go there. That kind of ignorance ends up with distrust, people saying you're not serving my needs or you're not serving me well or whatever. So we look for abuses first. Notice that. That's a more human element. Then we look for ignorance. Finally, to build relationships, the psychologists are absolutely clear on what they call the rules of psychology. Now you all know there's no such thing as a rule in human circles, in human function. But nonetheless, the psychologists are pretty well agreed on certain rules. And two of the rules, one which talks about external publics and one of which talks about both internal and external publics, the two rules go like this. One, people will consent to or carry out only those plans which they have had a voice in making. People will consent to or carry out only those plans which they have had a voice in making. In other words, participative decision making. Secondly, people inside the institution will do only those assignments which they are rewarded for doing, unless you are paid for it, honored for it, or assured that your promotion, pay raise, and so forth is tied to it, the chances of your doing it are slim. Because clearly we're going to concentrate on those things. And we call this the rule of understanding. That people will be involved only in those things in which they have an understanding. And that involves participation, and it involves the rule of rewards. Well, that cuts across, I guess, pretty much all spheres of what we do. I don't know that I need to elaborate on it, but I can tell you a tool that we're using. In our planning for the clients that we represent, we are now spending quite a bit of time on dealing with exactly those things. In other words, before we start with a lot of fancy magazines we're going to put out and meetings we're going to hold and feedback sessions and television and all that jazz, first we say, hey, are we wasting our time? Have we done ourselves the marketing job of knowing the needs and values out there. Because if you want to write a headline for all of this, it's for us in public relations to also look to needs and values. And so we make what we call abuse lists for each public that we want to reach. We talk about the levels of ignorance and we discover them by research. And then we make darn sure that if we're asking an inside public to carry out a function, that they are in fact being rewarded for it, that it's in their job description and their promotion package. And if we're asking outside public, we ask ourselves, we want them to do this, but have we allowed them to participate in the decision to do it? I think the answer to that determines then what kind of activities we're going to carry out in any kind of public relations program. Now, this may sound revolutionary to you, and you say, oh my God, you know, how will I ever get my institution to do this? And the only thing I can say to you is, take a choice. You don't have to. I mean, your institution can continue to ignore all this and say, ah, oh, you know, a lot of dreamers think this is the way it is. But if you're seeing what I'm seeing, it's not a lot of dreamers. This is what it is. And if you do ignore it, if we do ignore this, I think we're going to pay a very heavy price, and we're going to pay it soon. And just to emphasize that point, let me remind you of what is now happening in medical practice itself. In medical practice itself, public relations is rapidly becoming the key to a successful medical practice. Consider, a few years ago, you went to the doctor that was assumed to know the most, right? Had the most knowledge of the disease or whatever it was you were seeking. Because in those days, this meant reading the literature, keeping up with the studies, and all of that sort of stuff. And so therefore, it might be a gruff son of a gun that you went to as a doctor, but, you know, you felt you were going to get the quality of care that you wanted. Ah, modern information techniques have changed that. Because now every doctor, after they give you the diagnosis, they go to the keyboard, right? And they punch in measles, and up comes everything that is known about measles from the nearest medical information center. And any doctor that can put together jigsaw puzzles ought to be able to look at your symptoms and that information and make some kind, at least, of a reasonable match between the two. Therefore, what is the key factor? Why are people choosing doctors? Because of their bedside manner, would you believe? Right back where we were 100 years ago, because now the knowledge is available to everyone. We will no longer put up with a gruff, overcharging doctor. We want one that treats us like people at the same time as administering the same body of information that other doctors can administer. Interesting. Interesting, I think, something we should all consider. Given this kind of a situation, however, I think that the role of public relations, if you will, the actual jobs to be done inside an institution are very clear today. I think there are six roles for this function. And those of us who are practitioners, I hope, are already doing this. Those of us who are management personnel ought to be seeing to it that our public relations practitioners are carrying out all six of these roles. To be relevant today, a public relations practitioner has to be a researcher. I guess that's already true for most of us, but I think everything else I've said today emphasizes that point. You've got to find out what's really there and not just act on your perceptions. You've got to research to find out the true public perceptions. The second thing is we have to be strategic planners, because if we've got the research, it isn't any good unless it gets fed in to the strategic plan of the institution. And strategic planning certainly is where we can inculcate this marketing philosophy. So it's really, I just can't emphasize it enough. Here's our chance right here to do the research, apply it to strategic planning. We can help our institutions become marketing oriented, if you will. Let me just tell you a little story that I hope will nail this point home of what happens when you don't do strategic planning. It's about the young lady who went on the cruise, and she thought it was probably the only time she'd go on a cruise, and so she thought she had planned quite well. And in fact, she was thinking she'd never get the money to go again, and so she kept a log every day on her cruise. And this is what she wrote in her log. I think it illustrates the point about the importance of long-range strategic planning. On the first day, she wrote, "The ship is big and white and beautiful. It holds 600 passengers, and I think I'm going to have a grand time." On the second day, she wrote, "Things are better than ever. I've been invited to dine with the captain tonight." On the third day, she wrote, "Wow, the captain is quite young, very handsome, and I think his mother owns oil wells in Texas." On the fourth day, she wrote, "I'm getting a little nervous because the captain really seems to like me, and in fact, he's kind of pursuing me and suggesting I do things that maybe young ladies shouldn't do on cruises." On the fifth day, she wrote, "Horrors, my great plan has turned into a nightmare. The captain is really after me. In fact, he has said that if I do not give in, he will sink the ship." And on the sixth day, she wrote, "I just saved the lives of 600 people." See, if this was a day-long session, I have a million of those, but I've cut all the rest out. I told you the story for one simple reason, not to be a comedian here today, but to make the point that our ship may sink if we don't get into strategic planning and get this marketing philosophy inculcated. The third job that we have, and that managers ought to insist on from their public relations personnel, don't let them get away, managers, without being your counselors. Call them in and say, "Hey, I've got this problem." You're supposed to understand all about public relationships, how you build them, how you manage perceptions. What should I do? What should the institution do? And right there is a place to apply the research and the strategic planning at the actual point of management activity. Fourthly, we have to be educators. I mean teachers inside the institution. And that goes back to my remarks earlier about getting every member of the hospital family to participate in its public relationships. By the way, one of the ways that we are doing that, which may be useful to many of you, is we are actually writing in public relations responsibilities to the job descriptions of everyone in the hospital. From the orderlies right on up, in the job description is a statement, an appropriate statement, about their role in the relationships of that hospital, both among the staff, their role to not going around tearing down morale all the time, but to build it up, and externally. Now, I know it's just words on paper, but once it's on paper, they're going to pay some attention because now they know they're going to be rewarded or punished for not carrying it out. And it gives us an opportunity to say, "Hey, you know that number 62 in your job description? We're going to have a little seminar on that Wednesday afternoon. We'd like to come. We'd like to tell you what's going on at the hospital and how you can help by getting this data out to your friends and neighbors, or by listening to what your friends and neighbors are saying, or whatever the situation is." Key role. Public relations practitioners in the 80s are going to spend most of their time, in my opinion, being researchers and being educators. Trainers, if you will, of staff. Our fifth role is the old familiar one of being communicators. Yes, of course, we're the experts in the communication process, in the techniques, in the media, and by that I don't mean the mass news media, I mean all the media by which humans exchange information. Notice, of course, the word exchange. I think a lot of our work has been one-way kind of communication. And let me tell you a little story to emphasize what I mean by the importance of communication, but the importance of us shaping up our approach to it. I was giving a talk in New Orleans last year, and after I finished, I ran out to the cab to catch my airplane, and the conference was attended by a number of students as well as practitioners, and a group of students came up and said, "Can I take your picture?" Well, you know, I'm fairly well known in public relations fields, but I thought, this is kind of unusual. I'm not a media star or what have you. But obligingly, I lined up alongside the cab, and they snapped away, and I hopped in and took off. About 2 weeks later, I got in the mail the picture. Now, I understood why they had done this. It dawned on me in the meantime. You know, if you send students to a conference in New Orleans, they want to come back with some proof that looks like they attended the conference, okay? Makes sense. So, I got the picture. And this just shows how important it is to pay attention to communications, even while we've got all these other new jobs. There I was, you know, my bald head gleaming in the Louisiana sunshine, and right across the street, a big sign, typical New Orleans sign on the business across the street, which announced that it offered completely nude dancing. I have a hunch that isn't the message they intended to send, but I think you get the point. Yes, we cannot forget the importance of our communication role, even though we add these other roles. There's a sixth role that it seems to me we ought to expect of public relations professionals, and that is that we really are and ought to be the principal cheerleaders inside the institution. Now, I know that's a term that nobody likes to think about, and every manager likes to think that he or she is doing some of that cheerleading, but the fact is that it's tougher for senior managers, and it ought to be easier for public relations practitioners who are seen, I think, in most institutions as people who do that kind of job, who build morale, who emphasize the positive, who can point out the things we all ought to be uniting behind as we carry on our current projects, whatever they may be. Given this kind of a role, if you'll accept that building public relationships is the key, that there are certain ways, as we covered earlier, to build relationships, and therefore certain roles that the public relations function ought to have in the institution, let's examine now some of these functions and whether we may or may not be carrying them out correctly, according to the latest behavioral science research. But let me just stop here to make one point that I hope is becoming very self-evident, that the role of facts and information is far, far less important than most managers, and unfortunately many practitioners, think they have. What the facts are don't make much difference. Think of the last time you voted, for example. Did you really know what your particular elected official had done on a subject? I mean, did you investigate the record of how the vote was? Don't sit there and tell me you did. It's a lie. I don't do it either. But you listen to the other guy's campaign rhetoric, I'll bet. We had several instances in the recent election in the States where opposing candidates simply lied about the voting record. It's been known to happen in Canada. And the result was negative for that particular person. The facts don't count. It's people's perceptions of those facts. We've got to understand that. And so that when there's a problem, we don't just throw out facts. Man, we're going to give them the facts. Forget it. We've got to deal with their perceptions. The second thing that I hope is coming across is that there was a day when practitioners were primarily concerned with opinion. And we still use those marvelous phrases, the court of public opinion or just public opinion. But those phrases now have taken on a meaning of their own, quite apart from the words. In terms of opinion, opinion is far too flighty. It changes weekly, daily. Far too flighty for us to spend a lot of energy on. So we figured, well, I'll tell you what, let's go to people's attitudes. We'll go beneath opinion, and we'll get down and we'll deal with people's attitudes on which they form their opinions. And if we can somehow deal with those, we'll be better able maybe to handle perceptions. But that doesn't work either. So where are we left? Where we are left is that the goals of public relations today, and the primary reason for adopting a marketing philosophy, the goals are no less than motivating or modifying behavior. Friends, we are into behavior mod. I don't care. I represent a manufacturer of automobiles, and you know what? I don't really care how many people in the opinion polls love my automobiles. And I don't care how many's attitudes are favorable. What I want to know is how many people buy that car. It's the only bottom line I can pay any attention to. Of course, I know they're going to have good opinions and correct attitudes, which I'm going to build into my marketing process, or they'll never buy it. But there is then that last step where we've got to be able to deal with their behavior. This is the role in the mix of so-called selling or persuasion. It has a legitimate role, only, however, if we first built that marketing thrust. Let's take a look, having said that, at one of the things we spend most of our time on, and that is dealing with the mass media. I know from your own study of your membership that dealing with the press is something that most practitioners do and that almost all managers expect practitioners to do, because, of course, they don't want to talk to those crazy media people. And we saw last night, you know, those of us who were at the banquet, how crazy they can be. It seems to me that all the studies today indicate that our trust in the media is totally misplaced. And by that, I don't mean that they're going to be fair to us. We all know better than that, I hope, by now. But our trust in media as the cement in society, as the institution which puts out the information on which people can make decisions, and that therefore helps them to make decisions, forget it. I can't find a study, and I've done several myself, that shows that the media has any kind of a role like that. I am suggesting to you that the role of media today in our work should probably be half or less than it is. We are spending far too much time on media, and we are counting on media, frankly, to do jobs that they have no business doing, and we should be doing ourselves in our own alternative media. Let me tell you what I mean. As to the latter point, many institutions still think that every piece of information that they want to communicate is done by the mass media. Well, you know, the mass media, if they reported on everything that every institution had to communicate every day, the Globe and Mail, I estimate, would be about 500 pages daily. I doubt any of us would read any of it. So we must know that those things should not only not be entrusted to the media, we shouldn't bother the media with that stuff. Instead, we set up our own alternative media, which is targeted to the specific audience we want to reach. If we don't, information overload is going to just weight each of us right into the earth. Second point, the media, and we really have to face this, have for the most part given up their role of the famous fourth estate, the balance, the check and balance on government and on institutions. The media are entertainment, profit-making businesses. Now, I can say that with some surety, because not only have we owned media ourselves, I published a couple of newspapers when I was a boy, I mean, fairly good-sized newspapers, 60, 70,000 circulation daily, Sunday. I now have a position on a national institution in the States called the First Amendment Congress, where I sit with the 15 major media heads in that country, and we discuss these kind of problems because they're concerned. The public is losing confidence in the media. Incidentally, we've had several Canadian visitors. I know of your own recent study about newspaper monopolies very well, and the situation is the same on both sides of the border. The media can hurt us because people love to believe negative things. The media really can't do a lot of good for us, except in two areas. These are the two areas where our media work ought to be concentrated. One, what gets on the agenda for the real decision-making process, which takes place around the dinner table, around the water cooler, and at lunchtime meetings, in other words, when people talk to people and exchange ideas, items don't get on the agenda for discussion there unless they're called to people's attention on the media. You'll see something on television. Most people, frankly, make almost no value judgments on what they see on television. It's just there. But it is a topic to bring up the next day when somebody says, what's new? So you say, well, last night I saw so-and-so on the tube. So you can get things on the agenda by being in the mass media, and that includes having a song written, getting in a book. It doesn't just mean newspapers and television or radio. So putting things on the agenda for discussion, societally, is the first and most important role of the news media. The second role, and the way that we should use the news media, and notice that word, use the news media, not be used by the news media, is when we have new information, particularly healthcare education information. You've all seen the studies that information about health is now the most sought after of any category by the public, by quite a wide margin, by the way, over the next category. That one really turns people on. Why do you suppose we have medical reporters at even some of the smaller media? If we can begin to look at media as a an awareness vehicle for new information and an agenda participating vehicle for issues, then we're going to be using the media right. And we ought to take all the time we save from running after them to run every little thing which nobody pays a damn bit of attention to, because they see it as the passing parade, it's just entertainment. If we can take that time and apply it, indeed, to directed, targeted media and to building human communications back and forth instead of one-way message sending, now we're going to be on the right track to building public relationships. But don't take my word for it. Let me see if I can prove it to you. There are essentially three kinds of information that people seek or that people have thrown at them, either way. The first is what we might call must-know information. I'm going to see if I can get the number of humps right in the U this time. Must-know information. I really need to know that the road between here and the airport is torn up or I'm going to miss my plane. That's must-know information, okay? It affects my life here and now. There's not an awful lot of that in the daily papers, generally, and most of it, you know where most of it is? It's in the very back pages. But who sends out must-know information to people? You do. You tell them what's happening in the important things in their lives, their jobs, their schools, their hospitals, places like that. That's must-know information for them. That's what public relations sends out, not the basic news media. Secondly, there is nice-to-know information. It's probably good for me to know that there is a flu epidemic heading toward my town so I can, you know, go on vacation or whatever, or at least get a vaccination or whatever else I can manage. It's probably good for me to know that the federal government is cutting down on expenses in certain areas so I don't make any plans to enter those areas. You know, all this kind of stuff, which is keen to know and may someday be here and now, but for the moment is just floating out there. The third kind of information is the passing parade. In other words, entertainment. Studies done on news programming on television indicate that the average viewer makes no differentiation between the news from 6 to 6:30 and the soap opera from 6:30 to 7. A passive audience sits there, watches and figures, that's today's episode. Tomorrow's news will be tomorrow's episode. And unless the news is very scandalous, therefore negative, something that they want to hate an institution for, because it feels good once in a while, you know, to get even and hate those people. Unless it's that kind of stuff, most of it goes right over people's heads. But don't take my word for it. Let's talk about some recent examples. I think Canada is a good place to talk about the royal baby. Now that was really important, must-know information, right, gang? Man, I couldn't have done my job the next day if I hadn't known all the details about Di and, oh my goodness, the obstetrician and the whole business. How about the Falklands War? Really affected my daily life, didn't it? And yet we had camera crews and reporters all over that place when back home, there were stories that affected people's lives desperately that weren't being told, such as federal budget cuts in both Canada and the United States that cut the poor sometimes completely adrift, as cuts in healthcare research, in the support of hospitals, that actually are going to cost lives, people's lives, in the next few years. Did you read those stories in the headlines? Uh-uh. They were too busy entertaining us with the royal baby, the Falklands War, and you name it. Now, I am not castigating them, because they have now said that their role is to be profit-making entertainment media. And if that's their role, then they are doing their job. But it leaves a tremendous vacuum. Somebody's got to get the public the information that they need to conduct their lives, and someone then has to go to them and find out how they perceive it and react to it. And I guess it ought to be pretty clear who is going to do that job. If public relations practitioners did not exist in present-day society, society would have to, out of sheer necessity, invent them. Because somebody has got to do that job, or our society simply will not function. I went to the PRSA conference in San Francisco 2 weeks ago, and we had a doctor there who, as a kind of a hobby, has become a health correspondent in addition to his family practice. And he did a little study of television drama, and he found another side of the media that is quite frightening for healthcare. He found that this whole sense of lack of reality about healthcare is being created and fostered by media in giving instance after instance after instance in an entertainment setting, which becomes simply the norm. They're not particularly believed or disbelieved by people. People don't even make a judgment on them. But I mean, it's just there so often by repetition that people come to think that that's the way the world is. For example, in television drama last year, 50% of all pregnancies ended in miscarriage. 16% of all pregnancies resulted in the death of the mother. 4 times more women than men die of heart attacks on the tube. Fascinating statistics. 80% of all obese people, for some reason, are in minority groups. And hero figures make instantaneous recovery from violent assaults, such as being pistol whipped by 14 assailants. And in the next frame, man, they're up and going at them. I think you get the point. But let's just carry this a step further if we're going to talk about a scientific approach to public relations. And what I'm talking about now, the examples I just gave you were phrased in simple lay language. But those are the encapsulated results of hundreds of studies going back to pioneering work in the 1940s, of the real role of media. If we are still emphasizing our communications role as information officers, as representatives to the press, and if management is letting us get away with it, we're just making a mistake, friends, because that's not where perceptions are formed which cause people to behave in certain ways toward institutions and toward themselves and their own lives. Jim Grunig is one of the major current-day researchers on public relations themes, and he has just finished a new piece of research on what he, in typical academic terminology, calls a theoretical anatomy of a public communication campaign. What he means is, do public communication campaigns work? Does it really do anything anyway to get information to people? What he found, I think, is interesting. As you may know, there's a history of research in this field which first indicated that information campaigns were how people made decisions. You get them the information, they made the decision, and they acted accordingly. Subsequent, far more detailed information discovered that that was totally untrue, that people do not act on information. 30 years of such research has now nailed that down fairly tightly. Information is not what motivates people. But Grunig has found as follows in the present day. Let me just read you the results of his study. He says, the results of this study suggest